Are you ready for the weekend yet? We have events, news, and a guest for you to enjoy this Lake Life weekend. Hello and welcome to another episode of our Lake Life Weekend podcast. Yeah, stay tuned please. We have a great interview partner here, Brent Alcott from the Pelican River Watershed District, talking about shoreline protection and giving all kinds of insights on plans and how they support any of your projects. So stay tuned for that. And oof, I am still exhausted from this past weekend. It was in the 70s, and I spoke about sunscreen, and we used it, but still, I think we got sunburned. It's really nice, really strong. If you haven't put your boat in yet, or your dog, let me tell you, I put our boat in. I shared with you, I have a 1977 Checkmate, and yeah, we drove it to the public access. It fired up. We let it warm up a little bit. It's an old engine, and we took off. And then the motor went out. It was 10 minutes pedaling back to the access, and it fired up again. It warmed up a little bit more, and then I thought, let's just give it another try. And yeah, we got further, and it went off again. And I really don't know what to say. It never did that before. If you have some tips, I think the gas line, hopefully the gas can is just clogged. So we pedaled in the middle of the lake. We're one of those guys pedaling with a boat, and the wind, I was hoping the wind brings us over to our beach, all the way across the lake from the public access. It fired up again. Another boat was approaching us, but when it fired up, it left, and 10 seconds later it was dead again. So they came, rescued us, and pulled us to our lift. And yeah, thank you that. My son was really excited. He says, like, well, the good thing about that was we made a new friend on the lake. And that's true. Thank you, Mike, for rescuing us there in the middle of the lake. That was quite an experience. And yeah, well, one of our highlights for sure. If you have tips for my old Checkmate, feel free to email me at hello@lakelifeweekend.com. Another really nice thing we did, and another neighbor friend here, they have horses. And we went to a horse boarding place southeast of Frazee. I think it was Sandy's Oaks. I believe that's what it was called. It was beautiful. They had a clinic there today, and there were, like, I don't know, 30 horses with horse riders, and it was really nice to see. I love horses, and I hope to actually get her in for an interview sometime too, because Lake Life also is horses, I would say. So that was nice. We had a packed weekend. I put the canopy on our boat lift, fixed some boards, and Harry has a little pirate boat, so we let that swim. And I also said, if you go in, I will go in. And the water was really cold. He went in and I had to go in. And so our first swim in May, I think I lasted 4 seconds, maybe 4.5, but that was good. So yeah, more weekend fun to come. This whole week is going to be really nice out, and I hope that the water will warm up soon, so we can enjoy swimming, or we will just take the canoe. I don't know how soon I'll be able to fix my boat, but yep. Somebody told me a story once. What is it called? This when you own a boat, I don't know. It's always something to fix, and I hope it will last another summer here. Yeah, upcoming events. This weekend is Mother's Day, so Mother's Day weekend. Really some nice events. I think Fair Hills has a brunch. The Holiday Inn has a brunch. So if you don't have a really beautiful lunch brunch at home, you can take mom out. Here in Lakes Country is a lot to explore. I know that. Some other news coming up. That's interesting. Voting for the new casino and hotel at Cass Lake. Cass Lake. Oh, that's not the one at Star Lake. Okay. Oh, interesting. The vote for Leech Lake tribal members will take place Tuesday, May 16th. That's another week out, though. To decide whether the reservation should construct a new $45 million to $50 million palace, casino, and hotel. Meetings have already been held on the reservation and also in Minneapolis and Duluth. Ballots were sent in the mail to eligible voters already in April. So, yeah, interesting facts. We have some more places coming up here, possibly. So, stay tuned. You can find all news on that on our website, too, lakelifeweekend.com, and follow up. Here some other things. Minnesota DNR offers resource for lakeshore improvements. That's another resource that I can highly recommend. Now that spring is here, many lakeshore property owners are planning their next yard project. Property owners have a significant impact of the health of wildlife and the water based on how to manicure their lawn for the season. The Minnesota DNR offers online tools such as Score Your Shore and Restore Your Shore for landowners to use to implement when evaluating their property and planning their next project. You can find it all at www.dnr.state.mn.us/RYS. You'll find a link on our website too. So if you want to educate yourself on the DNR resources, and then also later you will hear about the Pelican River Watershed District and their resources for your projects. Some events. Homestead History, May 11th. History Museum of East Ottawa County in North Perham. Keith Butler will talk about the history of homesteading in Minnesota at the History Museum of East Ottawa County in Perham. That's already Thursday. It's a nice local event, 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. And then, if you want to hear some music again, Josh Turner is at the Shooting Star Casino on Friday, May 12th, 8 to 9:30 p.m., Shooting Star Casino in Minomen. John Turner will be performing at Shooting Star Casino. Ticket prices start at $25 for general, $40 for select, $55 for star. I guess that's a VIP pass or something. And then, this weekend, yes, walleye fishing opener. The Minnesota Walleye Fishing Opener is May 13th, this Saturday. Before you head out on the water, make sure you have an up-to-date fishing license and are familiar with all limits and regulations. This year's possession limit is 6 combined, not more than 1 walleye over 20 inch. Well, good luck. And then there's a spring vendor, blender, and craft show on Saturday, May 13th. 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Holiday Inn on the lake. The 9th annual Spring Vendor Blender and Craft event show will showcase local artists and crafts at the Holiday Inn, May 13th. All current events on our event schedule, so please drive to our website and find information there. Yeah, I don't want to keep you up from this interview, which I thought was really, really nice. So stay tuned, enjoy. Yeah, hello. Welcome again. I am here with Brent Elcott from the Pelican River Watershed District, and he will be talking a little bit about what he's doing and what the Watershed District is doing in the area. Welcome, Brent.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming. And tell us a little bit about yourself. Are you from the area? Did you come to Detroit Lakes?
Sure. No, I'm not from the area. I'm a Minnesota native. I grew up in Big Lake. It's a little town northwest of the Twin Cities, about 45 minutes or so.
Okay, direction Brainerd?
No, not quite that far. Yeah, same direction as Brainerd, but yeah. Not quite that far. By Elk River. Yeah, okay. just north of the Twin Cities. Not too far away.
Okay.
Graduated high school there, and then went to college at the University of Minnesota in Duluth.
Ah, yeah.
Where I got my degree in biology and minored in chemistry.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. So you're coming from the biology background.
Yep.
And how long have you been with the Pelican River Watershed District here in Detroit?
Oh, let's see. This fall it'll be 3 years, so about 2.5 years now.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And what is your role, and what does the Watershed District
do? Sure, I'm the assistant administrator. I've a few primary jobs, but one of my main ones is the residential and commercial permitting program. We have a permitting program that, depending on the type of activity or development that's being developed or built, may have a stormwater management requirement, something that you would have to manage the stormwater off of the impervious surfaces to meet the water quality goals to ensure that the water resources aren't degraded. And I'm responsible for administering that program.
Okay, well, wait a second. Let's step back.
Sure.
And I didn't mention, I actually met you a little while back at my Rotary Club.
Yep.
And then we met again at the Expo earlier this year, where you represented and were in touch with people visiting or living residents from the area. And so the watershed district serves the counties of...
Yeah, let me back up and just show, tell you what our range is. We're about 122 square miles.
Okay.
So we go from north of Floyd Lake in the agricultural region up by Campbell Creek.
Yep.
That'll be the northern extent of our boundary. And we go just south of Lake Melissa, kind of by the Bucks Mill Dam.
Yep.
That'll be our north-south area. And then east-west on the west side would be Pearl Lake. That area there, and then just east of Detroit Lake.
Okay. So, and there's more watershed districts, right? So you're one of many?
There are. Oh, I would have to look. I don't know the number of watershed districts off the top of my head, but in this area, it's just us. Cormorant Watershed District is to our west. Buffalo Red and Wild Rice are to our north.
Are you a government authority?
We are. We're a unit of government that's petitioned by the residents, usually for one of two reasons. One would be flooding or water quantity issues, where if it's prone to flooding.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue would be water quality. Mm-hmm. Ours was formed for water quality purposes. Mm-hmm. There was some pretty degraded waters 50, 60, 70 years ago. The citizens of this area petitioned the state to establish a watershed district. And we were established a little over 50 years ago, about 50 and a half years now.
Interesting. So in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. We celebrated our 50th anniversary this summer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
And it's right before building code got established. I think that was 71 on the lakeshore front.
Oh, for the the shoreland shoreland regulations. Yep.
Interesting. So the watershed districts in this area was, so we have a pretty straightforward community back then protecting Minnesota.
There was some pretty seriously degraded waters, especially Lake Sally was really bad back in the 60s and has rebounded wonderfully since.
Really? But, mm-hmm. So, okay, maybe later you can share a bit of the success stories here.
But absolutely.
So we have, you said, 122
square miles.
Square miles.
We have 144 lakes.
Oh, wow.
Within 122 square miles.
That's significant.
That's a lot of lakes.
A lot of lakes.
A lot of those are going to be smaller pothole natural environment lakes that don't have a whole lot of residential development on them. But we do have quite a few highly developed lakes in the area too.
And when does a resident get in touch with you?
Sure. So there would be kind of two different thresholds. Well, I guess three. For permits, any activities near the shore, within the shore impact zone. So for most of the general development lakes, that would be 37 and a half feet from the water.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing any activities in there, vegetation removal, tree trim or tree removal, riprap, if you wanted to put sand along the shoreline or on the water, that would be something that you would be required to get a hold of me to get the proper permits.
Okay, so if I improve anything close to the water.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So it's not building a house that close, we cannot build anyways. It's
yep,
way too close.
Yep.
37 and a half feet.
Yeah.
Unless you're grandfathered in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, and so you get...
Yeah, and the other thing I would like to say too is just because there's a permit requirement, or even if you aren't required to have a permit, I am open to people contacting me to get insight of what works and doesn't work along the shoreline as far as riprap or planting ideas. If residents are interested in how they can better use their land
mm-hmm.
and protect the lake, mm-hmm. That's what I really enjoy doing too.
And of course, that's all our goal, because we want to enjoy the waters as long as we can.
Absolutely. That's the mission of my organization, is just to protect and enhance our waters, both rivers and lakes. So
you work for the resident, finding the best solution to fulfill their project.
Exactly.
You don't work against them. You kind of want to say like, okay, if you want to do that, then we could go there by doing this.
Yep, okay. Exactly. And we have a set of rules that are established of what you can and can't do, based off of a lot of community input when they were established. We had biologists and hydrologists and a lot of people that came together to look at the difference in the type of land and how that would affect the adjacent public resource being the lake.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you mentioned planting, and I know that there are some native plants or some significant plants that help.
Absolutely.
I'm really uneducated, sure, compared to you. So everything, now to make it easy, it's rain water floating into the lake, and then how much it takes along?
Yes, exactly. So what we're, our major concern that we're trying to stop is phosphorus. It's a naturally occurring element, and in this area, it's the limiting nutrient for our lakes. So the exact amount of phosphorus directly correlates to the amount of algal growth, or the amount of greening, the green algae growth that you'd have in a lake. So the more phosphorus that gets there, the greener the lake becomes.
Okay.
And if you have enough of it, it becomes nutrient impaired, and you could actually have some recreational activities be inhibited. It could produce some algae that causes toxins. I don't know if you ever heard of cyanobacteria or blue-green algae. It produces.
Swim message? I don't know.
Blue-green algae. There was some stories last year and the year before down in the Twin Cities area where they had a lot of impervious surfaces that delivered a lot of stormwater that had high levels of phosphorus in it. That created this blue-green algae. That created a toxin that is pretty damaging to humans. There, I think there were some pets and dogs that actually.
Where's the phosphorus coming from? From the grass? From fertilizer?
So it's a naturally occurring element. Oh. It gets picked up in the atmosphere.
Oh.
It also comes off of fertilizer on lawns. Sediment, any sort of sediment, gravel, has phosphorus that's bound to it. Decomposing plant material can release phosphorus.
So it's actually natural. We just need to have it filtered through the dirt.
Yeah. So what happens when you have shoreline development? There's always, before we were here, there was phosphorus getting into the lake, but it was at a natural level. Mm-hmm. When we came here as humans and started building houses and driveways and roads, we didn't allow that rainwater to soak into the ground naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So what we are doing is concentrating that stormwater into confined and point outlets into the lake, and we're conveying it there at a faster rate, and we're not letting it go over the natural soils to be soaked into the ground, which would filter out the phosphorus.
Okay, it would get stuck in the earth.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you go through the sediments, a lot of the phosphorus would get picked up by the sediment particles, and it would get filtered through just like a sand filter or a carbon filter like you would have for your drinking water.
Interesting.
Same concept with phosphorus and...
Okay, sure. And now that actually, because if I am a resident, I don't want a green lake. So certain plants, there's solutions where I can stop the rainwater to just float right into the lake.
Oh, absolutely.
So beach is actually not enough, so we need some planting.
So the easiest and biggest impact that you could do as a lakeshore resident is planting a buffer along the edge between your lawn and the lake. What we would plant it with, or what you should plant it with, is a native vegetation that has a really elaborate and extensive root system. So what that does, it does two things. It helps stabilize the shoreline, so you don't have increased
erosion,
either from water or from ice that might push along the shore in the wintertime. The second thing it does is that it prevents stormwater from getting the lake by slowing it down and increasing the amount of infiltration, or the rate at which the water soaks into the soils. And then, being that it's a native plant and the root structure is so elaborate, it picks those nutrients up for its own growth. So that way it kind of, it's kind of like a sponge. It stops a lot of that phosphorus before it gets to the lake and picks it up. A lot of them are really pretty gorgeous, actually.
Yeah.
There's some plantings that a lot of people do with a lot of wildflowers. So
yeah.
they,
I've seen pictures.
Yeah, really good habitat for butterflies, birds.
Yeah, huh. Now that we know what we can do, how many projects a year in the area with your 122 lakes that you said, how many projects do we have a year, applications? How involved are you?
This is the first year that we have actually a program that we are helping fund these projects. So there's becoming more and more awareness and more research that's showing how big of an impact these buffers and these natural protections to the lake have to actually the, you know, protecting and enhancing the water quality. So the Watershed District this year, the Board of Managers approved a cost share program where we could actually reimburse the cost of the plant material that people would use. So for a residential property, we would reimburse $500 or 75% of what the plant material costs of what it, of planting a buffer.
That's good to know.
There's been a lot of interest in it. I've been promoting it pretty heavily, and there's been a lot of people that have interested in it, and we're getting some applications now
already
for
this spring season.
Yeah,
for
the spring and summer season for plantings. Yeah.
Interesting. So.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, continue.
The other thing that we do is we work pretty closely with the Becker County Soil Water Conservation District. They also have a cost share program where they actually help cover the labor costs associated with the plantings as well, whether they do it themselves or you contract with someone else to do it. So when you use those two local programs, the cost of the landowner is pretty minimal.
Like 25%?
Yeah, well, the cost for the plant material would be the landowner would only pay 25% of the of the plant material, and then the overall project in a lot of cases you could get 50% funding for the labor and the plant material from the Soil Water Conservation District, and then that would be used first, and then whatever was the remainder of that expense for the plant material, that's when the watershed dollars would help kick
so
in.
So significant. So
huge. Wow. I mean, projects that are really massive shoreline restoration projects are cheaper than riprapping the shoreline.
Interesting.
And that's kind of what our goal was, is to get some alternative solutions to erosion control and promote natural shorelines to help stabilize those shorelines and prevent erosion, instead of just doing the riprap, which isn't always the best solution and could be damaging to the lake too.
Yeah, we'll share later how and get in touch with you. That is also interesting, how to get a hold of the watershed district.
Yeah.
But so you're growing, tell us a little bit about the success story. So you said we had a really stressed Lake Sally.
Sure.
And what reflecting on the history, how successful has it been?
Well, you could ask some people on Lake Sally too. I know I heard a story that there were some people that used to mount outboard motors, like boat motors, on their docks so they could push the floating masses of algae back out into the lake. This would have been back in the 60s. So when the Watershed District was established, they started looking at different projects and how to control and manage the stormwater. And that's one of our main goals, is managing the stormwater off of the roads and impervious surfaces. So they started putting some stormwater management ponds in to reduce the amount of phosphorus that makes it to the lake and filtering that out. The other thing that happened was the construction of the wastewater treatment plant in the city of Detroit Lakes. That was one of the major contributors to nutrients coming into the system.
Oh, through St. Clair?
Exactly.
Oh, really? Yeah, St. Clair's? Yeah. Oh, so it carried through?
Yep. Well,
and fed the bacteria?
Yeah, so the existing wastewater treatment plant was built in the 70s, I believe. Don't quote me on the exact year, but I think it was the 70s that was built. And that discharges directly into Lake St. Clair.
Yes.
Now, the nutrients are a lot less now than with the wastewater treatment facility than they were before a wastewater treatment facility. So there was...
Oh, and directly in there.
Untreated water going into Lake St. Clair.
Ooh.
Now, Lake St. Clair feeds into a ditch we call Ditch 14 or St. Clair Creek that flows from St. Clair and feeds right into the Pelican River, just a hair downstream from where Detroit empties. So
Muskrat?
Yep, right upstream from Muskrat. So that flows through Muskrat and then down into Sally.
Oh, yeah, right there.
So that's where most of the nutrients were coming from that were impacting Sally so severely.
Wow.
So when the watershed district started putting some of these stormwater management practices on the ground and started controlling some of the stormwater and helped with the wastewater treatment facility being constructed to help treat some of the wastewater before it was discharged to Lake St. Clair and eventually into Muskrat and Sally, that's when we saw a huge change in
algae growth or whatever. Mm-hmm. So for the past 40, definitely 30 plus years, there has been a recovery. And Lake Sally is the most significant success story. Then what else happened?
So another big project that we did was Lake St. Clair. This would have been a little over 10 years ago now, 13 years ago now. We did what we called an alum treatment. So we had a aluminum salts that were placed in Lake Sally. And what that did was acted like a blanket on the bottom of the lake to stop,
St. Clair or Sally?
I'm sorry, St. Clair.
Yeah, okay.
To stop the phosphorus that was being released from those old sediments. So in the bottom of Lake St. Clair, there's about 12 feet of unconsolidated sediment that are left over from the old wastewater treatment facility and the lack thereof.
Kind of like this muck.
It
sits down in there.
Yep. So it's unconsolidated and it has a lot of, a ton of nutrients in there. It's old wastewater from the wastewater treatment facility.
It just sits down there?
Yep. Huh. So it sits on the bottom. Lake St. Clair is about 7 feet deep at its deepest, and then below that there's about 12 feet of these unconsolidated sediments that are releasing this nutrients into the water throughout the summer months.
Interesting.
So what we did is placed aluminum salts on the bottom to help block the input of those nutrients coming out of those sediments and to kind of capture them and seal them in the bottom of the lake. That stopped the amount of nutrients that was coming out of Lake St. Clair by about half.
So you put a blanket over
it? Yeah, it's kind of a blanket of chemical that you would put in there, and that settles out and it binds to the phosphorus irreversibly. So any phosphorus that is coming up, it binds to it and then
clogs and becomes a material?
No, it's not a material, but what it does is when the phosphorus is coming through there, the aluminum salts bind to it like chemically. Uh-huh. So then the phosphorus cannot be used for anything else and it stays on that. So it's not like a plastic blanket. It's more of like a chemical barrier that doesn't
filter.
Yeah, exactly.
And then what happens? It still goes, but it doesn't hurt anything.
Yeah, but so then the phosphorus is held down in those sediments.
Oh, it sits.
Yep,
and
it stays there. But over time, that starts to wear out. Think of it like your fridge filter. Over time, like you have a filter that's in your refrigerator with your water in the door. Over time, that becomes clogged with some of the dissolved minerals that come through in the water, and you have to replace it.
Okay.
Well, that's where we are on Lake St. Clair now. The average life expectancy of an alum treatment is about 10 years. We're at about 13.
Oh.
So we had a really good life of it, but now it's starting to fail. So we're looking at
Replacing it,
yeah.
And can you pull it out, or is it really chemicals?
It stays there. You wouldn't be able to see it. It looks just like sediment. It'll be the top, depending on how much is placed in there, the top 8 to 12 inches of those sediments will have that alum mixed with it. So when the phosphorus comes through, it binds.
Interesting. It's heavier than water, so it sinks on the bottom.
Yeah, so when you first do the treatment, you'll see the lake creates a flocculant, so it'll kind of foam up on the top, and then that settles out, and then it goes across the bottom.
I'm fascinated because you have a biology and a chemistry minor, and it really, you're practicing chemistry in nature to assisted perform.
Yeah, so what we're trying to do is do slight manipulations to kind of help slow or stop, it's a natural process for the phosphorus.
You're not
to
hurting
be
it, you improve, like you're, yeah. you're assisting it, you're mm-hmm. supporting it.
Yeah.
Huh. So we have St. Clair and Sally, and what else did we do? Did we, what else?
Well, if we're talking about projects that we did in the past, we were pretty active in if we go north in the district, let's go north of Floyd Lake, Campbell Creek area.
Okay.
There's an agricultural area up there with row crops that are, cultivated fields, usually in soybeans or corn.
Uh-huh.
We help get a lot of agricultural practices in there that help slow the stormwater and the sediment that gets into the lake. or not in the lake, into the river, and then eventually into Floyd Lake. So we used sediment control basins, which are essentially a berm in a valley. So when the water comes off of the fields during a rain event, it'll get stopped by that berm. Mm-hmm. The water builds up temporarily, so the sediment can settle out of the water. And then there's an outlet pipe in the middle of that basin that would deliver the water from that basin directly to the river underground, so you don't have the erosive water flow over the landscape.
Interesting.
Did I explain that?
I got
it. Okay.
Yeah, no, I did.
And then
because of the dam situation, like something like the sediment settles and it's not carried further.
Exactly. So what we're doing is we're creating, with the sediment control basin, a temporary stormwater pond. So the stormwater that's coming through a valley would hit that dam or the berm. The water would back up and create a small pond. And when the water velocity coming over land meets that temporary water, the velocity of the water slows down. And when that slows down, the sediment falls out.
That quickly?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now it's not going to stop everything, but the larger particles, it definitely
and they
does.
Settle.
Then they settle out kind of in that field there. Usually it's planted with native grasses.
Uh-huh.
That also helps kind of like as a filter, picks up some of the nutrients that kind of get settled out or filtered out in the sediment there. And then the water, there would be a vertical standpipe in the bottom of that sediment basin, and the water would enter that and then go underground down to the stream.
Okay, kind of. Kind of like a plug and a top that it was okay.
Yep. So then the water would fall down from the top. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. No, I'm fascinated. So we're really active in supporting.
And those were put in 2012 and 2013.
Oh, just recent.
Yeah. So those are pretty recent. And then I'm in the process of doing a study along that river to monitor the effectiveness of those practices, just to see how good they're working.
After 3, 4, 5 mm-hmm. years, we can actually have some statistics and some results.
Yeah, last year and the year before were the first couple of years that we had real good data, because they're becoming really established now, because we have to kind of wait for that vegetation to really establish and get a hold.
Yeah. Wow. How big is the group? Like, how many people work in the Pelican Watershed District?
Well, there's three of us.
Three? Okay.
So it's me, our administrator, Tara Getter,
mm-hmm.
and then our office manager, Brenda Moses.
Okay.
So we're the people on the ground, but we don't operate on our own with whatever we want to do. We're directed by a board of managers. So we have 7 managers that make the decisions of the direction and the practices that the watershed does with its activities. So we have representatives from most of the lakes, and then some from the agricultural areas too.
So this board of directors, is it an elected? How do I become?
They're appointed by the Becker County Board of Commissioners.
Wow, this is really complex.
Mm-hmm.
And they do this volunteeringly, or they're, mm-hmm. they're not on a payroll, so they're
no,
just very
they,
connected.
There's a small stipend or a reimbursement for it's but
150
it's,
bucks or something.
Yeah, about half of that, I think.
Yeah, okay.
But they're definitely not there to make money.
No.
It's more of a volunteer, but you kind of get some of the expenses covered for travel and money.
And they want to be. Okay, they're representing the best interest of the community, the best interest of nature in that way, in that sense.
Yeah, so we have different regions of the watershed district that are represented with the board of managers. So we have, a manager from Lake Detroit, one from Long Lake, one from the Sally Melissa Association, and then we have some from north in the agricultural area. So we try to get some people from every different type of environment or area that we have in the watershed district, so we have good representation of the district as a whole.
And they deliver the needs in a way.
Yeah. So they meet once a month, and then
once a month.
Yep. And then the district staff will kind of report on what we did last month, and if there's any new projects, and kind of inform them of what we've been doing, and then they make decisions on different projects that we'll be conducting.
So they have you're the executive, and they are kind of the...
Yep, they're kind of driving the bus.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even know. Like, highly organized.
Yeah, it is.
Really organized. So, and they're appointed by the commissioners.
Correct.
Said.
Yep. So when there are vacancies, they're posted, and then people that are interested would express their interest with a, you know, a letter of interest or kind of like an application and submit
to the commission directly of Becker County.
Correct. Yep. And then they would discuss, and then the commissioners, talk about what I just spoke on of the different regions and try to find someone to represent each of the interests that the watershed district has, and then appoint someone that they feel is fit.
Huh. Yeah. It's really fascinating. I didn't know how organized it is. And you cooperate with the Cormorant Watershed District? Like you're in touch? You share experiences?
Yeah, to a degree. They don't have as big of an office as we do. I mean, we have a pretty extensive water quality monitoring program that I run, a permitting program that that I'm in charge of. They have adopted the same rule set that we have, but don't have the water quality monitoring aspect of the district.
They have a smaller district? Is it kind of the same?
It's going to be similar in size, but smaller in staff, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. And we don't necessarily have a watershed district in each region, so it is established, like you said earlier,
So one thing that, that I try to clarify is that every area is a watershed.
Okay.
Every area drains somewhere.
Sure.
So we're the Pelican River watershed, mm-hmm. and we happen to have a Pelican River Watershed District, which is the organization that kind of operates or manages this area. Then we're part of the Red River or the Otter Tail watershed, which is the larger drainage area, which drains into the Red River watershed.
Okay.
So everybody, on the face of the earth will be in a watershed.
Sure.
And then within Minnesota, a watershed district would be an area that either had some impaired water issues or flooding issues, and then they were petitioned to the state to establish these legal boundaries to have this legal government organization help managing the water and the resources in that area.
Okay. Cool. So before we come to how to get a hold of you, if there's great interest, just I saw something at the NDSU landscape department once, and and most people know I'm not originally from here, but there's Red River Valley,
mm-hmm.
and the Red River is the lowest point going north to Winnipeg or towards Winnipeg.
Yes.
And everything feeds into this basin, right? It's kind of like a basin. And
like
we are at the bottom of a former glacier or something. Mm-hmm. No, we're not the bottom.
Oh, lake.
A lake.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that. Agassiz. Lake Agassiz.
Yep, that's right.
Part. I'm sorry, yeah. And so everything trickles down and eventually trickles down into the Red River?
From this area, yep, yep.
So we feed Red River.
And work, another one of the reasons, I know I kind of backtrack a little bit, that the watershed district was established is that we're considered a headwaters watershed. So the Pelican River watershed is at the top end of the larger Otter Tail River watershed. And then the Otter Tail...
altitude, we're higher? Or what do you mean?
Farther upstream.
Oh.
So we're like the farthest upstream. So whatever we do in this area,
we'll end up
water,
in Otter Tail.
In the Otter Tail
River.
And then whatever happens in that Otter Tail will end up in the Red.
Ah.
So we're kind of, what we do
affects everybody.
Affects our neighbors downstream.
Oh.
So if we don't take care of our land use practices and take care of our water gets to, the Otter Tail River, and that flows through a whole chain of lakes south of us in Otter Tail County. And then eventually that's into the Red and even to our neighbors to the north in Canada when it gets to Lake Winnipeg.
Yeah, so, it has a chain reaction.
Yeah, so we try to be good neighbors and take care of our stormwater so our neighbors don't have to.
Though. Mm-hmm. I really think it's good to know that we actually are proactive
yes.
for 50 years considering our neighbors. That's mm-hmm. really a good working society. And I hope we will continue with that approach. And actually the awareness for me as a resident, either as a weekender resident or like a permanent resident in the area,
mm-hmm.
that I'm it's kind of like throwing a pop can out of the window of a car. You better don't do that.
Yep.
And like the same with me owning Lakeshore. Whatever I do, if more people do it, has a negative impact on...
Yeah, a public resource. And that's the nice thing about Minnesota is that the lakes aren't owned by anybody. Anybody can use the lake. They're public. So people that live on the lake get to use them, but people that don't live on the lake have the same benefit of using these public resources. And when you have private land or private property around the lake, what happens there can affect a public resource. So that's why we're so active and trying to take a proactive approach of managing and helping educate people to make wise land use decision. We're not anti-development by any means. I mean, it's important for the community to grow and thrive, to develop. We're just trying to help educate on responsible development ideas and practices that we can develop and grow our community while still protecting and preserving one of the reasons why our community is here for the public, for the lakes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good. How do we get in touch with the Pelican River Watershed
District? Our office is in the Wells Fargo building here in Detroit Lakes.
Yeah.
If you go to our website, it's prwd.org, so Pelican River Watershed District. So
okay.
prwd.org.
And we'll share that on our website.
Okay. Yep. And then our numbers will be on there. My contact information on what will be on there. So if you want to give me a phone call at the office, send me an email.
And also more of what you do, your mission is, and how
So then on there too, it'll show a little bit about what I do as far as research and water quality monitoring.
Yep.
So, making sure that our lakes are maintaining at a good water quality level, aren't being degraded, and that's the other part of our goal. So
good. Anything you want to add?
It's construction season, and everyone's looking at improving their lake property. So if there are any questions, or whether you know you need a permit or just aren't sure, or if you just have any questions about what you should or shouldn't do, or what you can do to help the lake, not necessarily required to do, but what you can do to help benefit, give me a call. That's what I got into this line of work for, and I really enjoy it.
Share your phone number, just 218.
Sure, 218-846-0436.
Yeah, super. Brent Alcott, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you much for having me. I had a wonderful time.
Yeah, well, I hope we see you again, actually, like when there's updates. I really like this educational component to what we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you'll have to have me back. We're in the process of having a very large project go in, a $1.5 million wetland restoration project going in north of Detroit Lake.
Wow.
That will hopefully start this fall. So
okay.
I just wanted to put a teaser out there.
Yes,
so you get me back and I can talk about another fun project we're working on.
Super. Thank you very much.
And if anyone is interested on that Rice Lake restoration project, we do have some links on our website too. So
thank you. Thank you for sharing. Okay. Well, thanks and have a good afternoon.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Yeah, this was already our newest episode of the Lake Life Weekend podcast. We sure hope you enjoyed it. Tune in again next week with another great guest and updates. Always check out our website, lakelifeweekend.com. And if you have some comments, please feel free to email us at hello@lakelifeweekend.com. And you have a wonderful weekend ahead.